Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Well, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I'm here with my good friend, Professor Bob Pucci. How are you, Bob?
I'm good.
I heard you recently retired from the professorship.
I did, from SUNY Ulster. I'm now a professor emeritus, I guess that's what they call
me. Wow, that sounds fancy.
You know, that, and what's the fare now in some ways? I don't know. But,
That and $250 will get you on a train.
Yeah, something like that. It used to be a token.
So how are you enjoying retirement so far?
Well, I've been too busy, I think, to enjoy it. And I still have to get into the rhythm of it because, you know, you're so used to working. And according to the Social Security Administration, I've been racking up points since 1974.
Nice.
So I guess it's difficult to get out of the rhythm of the semesters working. And actually today was development day, which is usually the day just before the first week of classes, which starts on Monday. And, you know, it's one of those obligations. You had to be there. And, of course, I wasn't there. And so I it's going to be interesting how I feel kind of like, you know, next week when theoretically I'd be in the class.
Mm. Well, you just recently retired, right? Like a month ago or something?
Yeah, officially August 15th, but I haven't had any obligations since May. Had a couple of, I don't know what to call stray students, you know, who had needed things and took care of them for graduation, for example. But, but I have not seen a piece of email directed towards me specifically in quite some time.
That's a beautiful thing, too.
Yeah, I guess so. I do get to keep my email, so they could call. But
for those of you who have been watching us for a while, know you would remember we had Bob on, one of our first guests on this podcast, about 64 years ago or so.
64. Yeah.
I think it was last May we started or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And you were one of our first guests, and we talked about communications, which is what you taught, right?
Media. Right. Media studies, journalism, film, public speaking, which everybody had to take and everybody wanted to. I was always astonished that there would be students who were, you know, taking the class as they were graduating. They put it off, and I often said that, you know, they probably cost themselves half a GPA point by waiting, you know, because I always said it's not what you know or who you know, it's who knows you know it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't speak, how will they know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't make yourself a presence, you're only your average.
Did you teach debate, too?
I tried to in this advanced public speaking class. It was supposed to be an honors class, but they really didn't quite get it.
Yeah.
So I think
that seems like an art form that's fallen by the wayside, too.
Yeah, it's interesting because
they go right for the gun.
Bronx High School of Science, where I graduated from, has the nation's leading debate team. So it's still alive somewhere, but not out here in Ulster County Community College. And I think part of the problem is it's like a lack of information.
In terms of what? A lack of information in terms of selling the course to the student?
Well, no, it's more lack of an information of having something to say. Say, when you, I had a class where I, it was called media literacy, and I thought a good thing about media literacy would be to see how plugged in people were, you know, and so I gave an old-fashioned current events quiz once a week, and when nobody could score more than 3 out of 10, I stopped. And, you know, the lack of awareness of what's going on, you know, they couldn't necessarily name the senators from New York State.
Oh, it's very to give you a quick preview, somewhere in the near future, we're doing a podcast. I want to discuss with you and a couple other people in the teaching profession my impression about the level of education in this country and tying it into the development of the Department of Education back in 1977. It's been declining ever since.
And I think it was declining before that.
Well, yeah.
You know, I think part of the problem was that I would start with English, which was, you know, it's a very basic subject. It's something that everybody has to learn to read and write. And round about the late 1960s, there was people coming out of grad school, going into teaching, who didn't want to burden the students with rules of grammar and spelling. They wanted them to be expressive, you know, and so they assumed the grammar and the spelling, but I think what happened was that people became further and further away from the very basics that would give them the ability to teach themselves, and also the impulse to teach themselves, because it's like somebody else is supposed to be responsible for it, not me. In fact, I think there was something where someone was talking about someone who was at Columbia, and they overheard them saying something about a quiz, saying that, well, you know, he didn't say that was going to be on the test, and so therefore I'm not responsible for not getting it right, for not knowing it. And
so they want the questions before the test.
Well, they want to know. I've heard so many times people saying something like, "Just tell me what I need to know," and my response has always been, "I don't know what you need to know. You know, I can tell you different things, but." I don't know if you need to know them. You have to decide what you need to know, because that's what's going to stick. You know, everything else is, you know, in one ear and out the other. You know,
yeah.
Sort of like you take Western Civ, and you take the unit test on the Egyptians, and then the Egyptians.
Well, what's the core problem? Is it a teaching problem? Is it a learning problem? Is it somewhere in between?
Well, I think on the teaching side, people have kind of tried to lower their standards to meet what they're getting. On the learning side, you have students who have become very passive. You know, and they don't, they're not motivated to teach themselves. I had one student who was in my journalism class, and he very interestingly said to me once, you know, it's sort of like, you only teach things when you want to know them. And I said, well, I'd be wasting my time any other time, wouldn't I? If you don't need to know it, you don't want to know it.
I apologize for that. That was my phone.
That was your phone.
We did have another gentleman that was supposed to join us, but that's probably him calling. So somewhere in between, you think?
They're
trying
so.
To meet that middle. The student is getting up to here, and the teacher's going down to there.
Right. They're trying to get them through. Although I always say that, you know, a degree without an education is eventually worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because a degree only gives you, I don't know, the license to apply. But whether you have the skills or the knowledge to actually do a particular job, you know, is something that is determined, hopefully, in a good interview. And maybe you don't get a job as a result. And then you have a degree, but you don't have a job.
One of the things you taught, in addition to those communication skills, et cetera, was movie. What was it? Movie?
Film, yeah.
Film, yeah.
Yeah. Something called Art of the Film and World Cinema. And I think that, you know, it was also interesting there because a lot of students would take the class in their last semester thinking that we were going to see Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3 or Batman, and, you know. And they got a serious course in understanding what they're looking at when they look at a film. And some of them were just like, gee, this is harder than it should be. But I made no apologies for it because the people who came out of it, I had one student who went to Tulane in a film program, and he wrote back to me and said that my film course was better than the courses they had there.
Wow.
So
You studied old film predominantly?
Yeah, well, I sort of incorporated more new films to kind of like keep them interested. And basically, I start out with taking the five components of film and giving an example of film for each. So for structure, I choose the 39 steps. The cinematography on the waterfront. For mise-en-scène, which covers everything, including actors' movements, Grand Budapest Hotel, and then as an alternate, The Graduate, because Grand Budapest Hotel is way over the top, and The Graduate is very subtle. Mm-hmm. And so they get to see the same...
When you say it's more subtle, you mean the director's approach to...
Oh, well, everything. You know, the scenery is more subtle, mm-hmm. symbolic. The acting is more internal and very sort of subtle with the gestures. It's a nice contrast. But I also, while I'm doing this, I'm also teaching a progression of history of film. And by the time we got to The Graduate, we had something called New Hollywood, where all of the old fossils of the producers were checking out. Companies like McGraw-Hill were buying movie studios, and young filmmakers were given a chance to try new things and to also break down the code system that existed, which inhibited subject matter and what you could depict.
That the Hays Code was called?
Yeah.
And that went into when? How long did that?
Well, it started in 1934. So movies that were made before 1934, things like Public Enemy, All Quiet on the Western Front, had, for example, a certain liberty that movies that were made between 1934, technically 1970, but by the mid-60s, the system was breaking down. And it was replaced by the famous GPG, PG-13RX.
Do you know the history of the Hays Code?
Oh, yes.
I'm just curious. There had to have been one or two films that prompted that code to come into existence.
Well, there were a couple of scandals that prompted it to come into existence. There was the Fatty Arbuckle scandal, where he was supposedly raped and by raping killed this woman. And he was put on trial three times and was acquitted both times, but it ruined his career. Mm-hmm. And it cast this... this pall over Hollywood. There was another famous murder of a director who was gay. And, basically it all sort of fell upon the Catholic Church to suggest that they were going to boycott movies and tell people to boycott films unless something was done about it. So the Hays Office was founded, and the idea being that this office would vet scripts and vet the final film and take out anything that could be construed as morally objectionable.
So there's no one particular movie that I can YouTube right after this podcast?
No, but you could look at a number of them. Mae West movies, any of the pre-code movies, which had a number of instances of partial nudity, obviously sexual situations and also questionable morals. There was the famous case, I don't know the film, but supposedly a man was cheating on his wife and she kills him. And after the Hays Code, she has to forgive him. And the idea of maintaining the family and maintaining, what we might consider a moral standard. All violence had to be suppressed. Kisses could not last more than a particular amount of time. There were interesting ways in which people tried to get around this. Alfred Hitchcock, for example, in Vertigo, has a couple kiss, and as they kiss, the camera moves around them. Mm-hmm. So you're not seeing them kissing, you're seeing the back of one head, then the back of another head, and then the kissing. So they're kissing for more than 5 seconds, but they've been kissing the whole time, the camera's been moving. Mm-hmm. And it happened one night. Frank Capra did a number of of risque things, you know, that were kind of like the scene where they're, you know, spending the night together and they're not married, and Clark Gable puts up the blanket and it was sort of making fun of the whole Hays Code. And there's one scene there where, you know, you can obviously see the outline of Claudette Colbert's breast. But you know, it was just like, well, it was just within the boundaries. And of course, W.C. Fields and Mae West in their films, they don't want to talk under their breath. They said things that you know, the censors did not pick up. They weren't in the script. So the censor is looking at the script and they're looking at the film. What did he say?
Really?
Yeah.
That's how it happened?
Yeah, so they would slip things through.
So the Hays Code, was that still in effect when Marilyn Monroe came around?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
like the 7-year itch, and
yeah, officially it didn't really end until 1970, I think, when they replaced it with the.
There's a scene that sticks in my head. I think it's the 7-year itch, where she's sitting in front of an air conditioner.
Oh yeah,
is that the 7-year itch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's a little suggestive.
Oh yeah, well, they would try. They would push the envelope as much as they could. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, you know, showing...
Who directed the 7-year itch, do you know?
I forget that. But it's one of those things that, you know, obviously homosexuality was taboo, although in Public Enemy it suggested that the person who grooms Jimmy Cagney and his friend is gay. And then, of course, there's that great line in... Bringing a Baby, where Cary Grant is dressed in a dressing gown and fuzzy slippers, and the woman asks him, "What is he doing dressed like that?" And he says, "I thought I'd just turned gay," you know. And
but the word gay didn't have that connotation, right?
Well, people knew what he meant by it, but I guess, you know, that was something else that, you know, kind of slipped past the censors. Again, it may not have been in the, you know, the script is submitted, and the people who were watching these things were kind of like, you know, they were not very interested. It's, you know, there's a board now that sits and watches a movie to determine what the rating is. And there's a very famous story about a movie that received an R rating for what seems to me to be a very sort of trivial thing. I'm trying to think of the name of the movie, but in the movie, this middle-aged couple finds a joint and they smoke it. And
it's not Reefer Madness.
No, it's not Reefer Madness. And it's really just kind of like, you know, leads to them kind of loosening up and having a romantic interlude, which is fine. But the censors decided that it was an R-rated film because they did not express regret for having smoked it.
Mm-hmm.
Had they expressed regret, they would have been PG-13, which is the golden standard. You know, you always want your movie to be PG-13. If it's a movie for young adults or kids, and it's going to be rated G or PG, they throw in a couple of goddams and a bloody nose so that it gets PG-13.
And... PG-13 is, you got to be 13 or over?
Yeah, parental guidance suggested, you know, 13, you know, being kind of like, you know, they can't see the film.
I often wonder if you took somebody from, say, 1929 and plopped them in a movie theater today, what the reaction would be to some of today's movies.
Well, 1929, that was pre-code, so they probably would not have been... as shocked as you might think. You know, certainly all the language that you might hear in a film today was, you know, part of the argot of the day in the 1920s. Just like, you know, the idea that couples always stayed together.
But even pre-code, you couldn't curse, right? You didn't curse.
Yeah, well, they didn't curse. I mean, there wasn't, you know, cursing in a film is really a kind of, it's a lost leader in a way, because if you use it once, it has great power. If you constantly use it, it loses any value.
Oh, no, I throw it out there all the time.
Yeah. Well, for example, once we were, this group was going to put on a play, and we're reading the play. And the characters are two people sort of like caught in some kind of post-apocalyptic situation, and they're cursing back and forth, The first time we read through it, sounded like, oh, yeah, that's really raw, it's really realistic. Second time, all we heard was the curse words. But we realized that most of them were not necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, and that I have a very good example of this. I've worked, well, almost every office I've worked in, you know, they say, like, you know, curse like sailors or truck drivers. My father didn't really curse very much. He was a truck driver. But you know, there's this whole idea that, you know, there's a certain, I don't know, class or whatever that's going to curse all the time. I did a play called Savage in Limbo, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of, you know, kind of like the Bronx alphabet, after this, after that, you know, whatever. But I worked in this office, and everybody cursed all the time, except for one person. Her name was Ann Redding. And she was very proper. She always dressed very, very well. She never, ever, ever cursed. One day, she stopped the entire office dead when the printer was not behaving. And she said, damn.
See, the word damn?
She just said damn, but everyone was like, oh. Ann Redding said damn. So, you know, if you don't curse and then you curse,
that's like, what's his name in The Gone with the Wind, right?
Yeah, right. Right. Frankly, Scarlett, they don't give a damn.
They're Clark Gable. Who the hell was it?
Clark Gable. Yeah. And there was a big discussion about whether they could have that or use it.
I remember that was a big deal.
Yeah.
Was that post Hays Code?
No. It was right in the middle of it. But you know.
I meant post implement.
Oh, yeah, 1934. So 1939 would have been, you know, right in the thick of it.
Was that in the book, the word damn?
I can't remember. I think maybe it was, which may have been the way they justified it. Mm. But it was always kind of like, you know, a negotiation, if you will, about, you know, what could be said or how it could be said. Preston Sturges, who was a director of films in the 40s, he was always playing with that, kind of like, you know, pushing the envelope, showing things that, you know, he knew was going to upset someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like he had black and white prisoners drinking from the same cup in this one scene, you know, in Sullivan's Travels. He also has Veronica Lake in the shower, and someone comes in to give her, you know, a dress to wear, and she presses the shower curtain against her breast, and you can clearly see her nipple, you know. And so there were different ways.
When she said nipple.
Yeah.
What's your favorite movie of all time, if you have one, and why?
I don't know. That's so hard because, you know, instead of my favorite Italian movie, my favorite French movie, you know. But it's very difficult, you know. I mean, there are movies that... for example, like Casablanca, that I could watch all the time. Somebody put up something about, you know, Key Largo, and, you know, that's another movie. It's got some false moments in it, but it's also got some great moments in it.
Key Largo?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know.
That's with Bogart and Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah. It's Johnny Rocco.
Yeah.
I used to be big, you know.
Where's your Moses now? See?
Yeah. Now, well, you know, I always laughed. You know, what is it? I think it's in Ben Hur. He's the architect of the Pharaoh.
Uh-huh.
And so at one point he's got a line. He says, I'm going to Goshen. And I'm like, Goshen, New York. You know, the way he says it, his accent.
Where was he from?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn? Okay. Brooklyn. Yeah. He was in the Ten Commandments, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
where's your Moses now? Yes. The greatest carpenter of my life.
Yeah, it's sort of like. But he was a very educated man, had a fantastic art collection, impressionists.
My favorite piece of him, I can't remember the name of the movie, he finds this coat. It's like a magical coat. There's like five or six little vignettes this movie about the same coat. Charles Lawton.
Mm-hmm.
wears it and he becomes a conductor, a composer, conductor, conducts his own opera or whatever. And then he gives it away, and then Edward G. Robinson, he's on the Bowery, on Skid Row, and he wears the jacket to a reunion of his graduating class of college, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very good in that movie, and I wish I remember the name of it during this, but I could put it in the show notes, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
Post-edit, man. Post-edit magic.
You can find out, find out what it was.
Yeah.
But there
and I'll put the director of 7 Year Itch in there, too.
I think there are a lot of notes
in this one.
There are a lot of films that are kind of like, you know, go by and are underappreciated, and then they're sort of picked up later.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Laughton, for example, directed only one movie, Night of the Hunter. And it's very famous for Bob Mitchum having love and hate tattooed on his fingers. And
I didn't know he directed that.
Yeah, and it was his only film, fantastic cinematography, and great, great acting, Shelley Winters, and just the scenography of it is very incredible. And the Coen brothers adore it because they quote from it all the time. But when it premiered, it, you know, barely made a ripple. Charles Laughton didn't get any other offers.
Maybe he was over budget.
I don't think so. It was a pretty simple movie. And I was thinking, I was looking at it was like the teaser for Key Largo, and I was looking at all the shots, and one of them was kind of like B-roll, public domain shot of kind of like the Florida coast. And then there was one exterior shot of a building. And then the rest of it was all done inside a studio. And at one point, the walls, the molding doesn't line up on the walls. And this is, and it's like,
Well, that's harder to judge. Like a layman like myself, I can tell someone is a good actor from someone who's a bad actor. But cinematography, I don't know. I'm not nuanced enough to know what's good and bad cinematography.
Yeah, well,
you can cheat and just show like Niagara Falls. Oh, look at the cinematography! But
well, I think that there's a it's a real art. And
well, what goes into it? I don't understand.
Okay, so
the difference between good cinematography and bad.
Okay, so a good cinematographer is always conscious of light.
Mm-hmm.
Is always conscious of composition, always conscious.
When you say composition, what does that mean?
What is in front of you
in
the frame.
Okay.
What's in the frame, what's out of the frame.
Like us, we're in the middle of my antique store. Here.
Right, the angle of the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a low angle up? Is it a straight ahead angle? Is it down?
Mm-hmm.
Is the camera moving? Is it tracking someone, following someone? And all of these are choices that are not necessarily, in the shooting script, except in a very sort of general way, And so choosing the setups, because the setup is like, for example, this is a two shot right here. Now, if we were doing a film, there would be two other cameras, or there would be separate setups. One just with a close-up on me, one with a close-up on you, and then the editor would switch between you listening, you talking, me listening, and that's the editor's skill. But the cinematographer has got to set up those shots.
How much of that is the cinematographer, and how much of that is the set director for the composition?
It depends on the director. Somebody like Kubrick shot a lot of his own scenes, and so he was...
Meaning he set the scenes up himself?
Yeah, and he shot them with a 35mm Auerfox.
Oh, he used the camera, okay.
Yeah, and he used the camera. And some directors use the camera, and others are just like, trust to the cinematographer. That's what you do. But they usually talk about what kind of effect they want. And so if you look at a film, for example, that's set in New York City, and it's a comedy, as opposed to a film set in New York City and it's a drama, you'll see all different kinds of choices of angles and composition, and even the color shift in the film, the color stock,
And that's enhanced or de-enhanced in the editing process?
Well, no. I mean, the cinematographer chooses the film stock. So, if he chooses a color film that tends to the blue end of the spectrum and is a little grainy, he's doing it because he wants to get a gritty documentary type effect. And if he's choosing one that has more of a redshift and has very bright lighting, we call it high-Q lighting, with its very little shadows, then he's trying to get this other effect, a comic effect. Now, Central Park can be a playground or it can be menacing. Mm-hmm. It can be barefoot in the park or it could be, the Charles Bronson vigilante.
Death Wish.
Death Wish. Yeah. It could be Death Wish.
Yeah.
And it's the same park. Mm-hmm. It's the same backgrounds, but it's how it's shot.
Mm. That makes sense. But I think nowadays a lot of it is filmed digitally, right? So all of that could be
You could do it
manipulated, right?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, before digital, there was something called the process shot. And what that was there was like a blue screen or a green screen behind the actors, and they projected a background.
Mm-hmm.
And
like we have here.
Right.
Because we're actually sitting in a parking lot in City Field.
Right, right. And when I did my Zoom classes, I did them from my office at home, and I've got a wall of books behind me, and they were asking me, is that a digital set, or is that my actual library?
And so you have to turn around and grab a book.
Pull books off there. So, no, it's my really library. But when they did the process shot, someone would go out and film, for example, you would see this a lot in films when people are driving. The scenery behind them is changing and they're talking and not looking at the road. That's a process shot. And I remember that there was one in the early days, they had to get the scale right. And there's a shot in Tarzan where the principals are walking past the natives. And the natives are out of scale. They're all about 8 feet tall, But they got better and better at this. Although I have to say, if you want to see a really bad example of the process shot, it takes a thief. The Alfred Hitchcock movie, terrible process shots. But the process shot was so perfected by the end of World War II that a couple of the people in the studio said, we'll never have to go on location again. And of course, at that point, Italian neorealism came into focus, and suddenly they were shooting out on the street with available light, and all these process shots flipped off in the funny. And that's why we get something like On the Waterfront, which is actually filmed, on location, rather than kind of like, Hollywood with phony backdrops.
Yes, like especially when people are driving.
Yeah, the driving was always bad. Although, I think if you watch A Touch of Evil, Orson Welles, obviously rejected that idea. And he had a truck with a crane, shooting the actors driving.
So they were actually driving?
Yeah, they were actually driving.
Now that's asking a lot of an actor to drive, operate a motor vehicle, and act at the same time.
Well, chew gum and walk.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, it's not really that bad, except that actually I think it was probably more difficult to maintain the illusion that you were driving when we're having this scene, with this other actor and you're looking at them the whole time. And like,
well, barely have the hand on the wheel.
Watch the road.
Yeah, right. It is distracting. Yes.
Kind of like,
and sometimes the scenery is like, what are you doing, 130 miles an hour?
Right.
Yeah.
So digital effects, have made it cleaner in some ways to do things. It's avoided a lot of makeup. you know, because you can set up the actors with these little sort of pixel points, and you can project on them, you know, all kinds of incredible makeup.
You know, it's incredible. I was looking at The Irishman with De Niro, and they actually digitally enhanced him to make him look like 25 years younger than he is, or 30 years younger than he is.
And it was,
and he does.
Yeah. I think it was sort of, I didn't really buy that scene where he's, you know, his truck breaks down at the beginning, and Joe Pesci comes over and fixes it for him. You know, he just doesn't look like a kid.
No, I understand what you're saying, but...
But
he didn't look like current Robert De Niro, either.
The current Robert De Niro is the Robert De Niro in the last scene.
You know? Yeah.
Right? And the current Joe Pesci is the Joe Pesci in the last scene.
It's very... Some of it is unsettling. Like, I don't particularly have a desire to see Abe Lincoln blinking and smiling and having his head turn on. Have you seen those photographs they do?
Oh, yeah.
You know? I like the color. I like the color. That's the big trend now, is colorizing the old.
Oh, yeah, the colorizing the pictures.
And speed correcting and, you know, whatever, digitally enhancing it. There's a couple of channels on YouTube that I follow that do nothing but that. Films from, like, 1880 through 1920.
Right.
And they colorize it, and it's surreal.
Yeah, colorizing has gotten much better. When the problem started with Ted Turner, you know, he spent $1 billion and bought up the entire MGM catalog. And at the time that he did that, MGM had already acquired the catalogs of almost all the other major film companies. So basically, that's what started the VHS revolution, movies on VHS.
The blockbuster era.
And he thought that people would like the movies better if they were colorized. And so sometimes to do this in terms of the costumes, they would go to the morgue of the studio and they would see the costumes. And they would say, okay, so that was blue or that was red or whatever. But they didn't realize that the costumers of the period chose a costume by how it would look in black and white. So, if it was brown, it was because it had a certain tonality. Here's Barry.
So in the wild and wicked world of podcasting, the person that was supposed to come
finally showed up.
But we're gonna reschedule him, and we'll have him back. I don't want to mention his name.
Okay.
Because he's a famous guy. He's like Elvis Presley. But so you don't have a particular famous film.
No, I mean, I was thinking once that I would, if I was going to write a book about film, I would write a book called Perfect Films. And these would be, you know, films that I think are so well done and, have so few, if any, flaws that they, occupy a special place. Mm-hmm. You know, because of all of the elements are so well integrated, and all of the acting, the cinematography, the editing, just all flows together beautifully.
You are retired now.
I could perhaps.
Even lend you a pen.
All right.
And a notebook.
Right. The very famous story.
It's actually a book that I wouldn't mind reading, because you're obviously very knowledgeable about film. If you wanted to slap one of them together, I'd definitely be interested in purchasing one from
you. Okay. All right. Well,
I want a discount, though.
You'll get it.
I want a signed copy so I can read it and put it on eBay.
Okay. All right.
So, but you don't have a particular one. How about a top five or a top three?
Top five. Well, I think I would have to go with The Bicycle Thieves. I'd have to go with something like The Graduate, something like Grand Budapest Hotel. I mean, these are all...
We're not ending this podcast till you mention It's a Wonderful Life. I was going to bring up, actually, before the guest came,
poster.
I saw that in your house, but no, there was a big to-do, in fact, when the colorized version of that came out to tie into what we were just talking about.
Right, right. I mean, and probably because, again, you know, what they were choosing as colors, you know, probably were based on false information because, you know, I don't know if you...
I think if they colored it now with the more modern technology in the digital world, it would probably look better.
Oh, yeah. It would. But it's interesting that when Martin Scorsese was making the boxing film with Robert De Niro and it was going to be all of this blood, you know, in the region.
Oh yeah, that's a great.
And so they filmed it, and it didn't look right, you know, because they were using the typical stage blood, which is Cairo syrup and red dye number 2 or 3 or something like that. So what did they wind up using? Hershey's chocolate syrup,
really,
which looks a lot better in black.
And now, you don't want to colorize that.
No.
Because you don't want to see that coming out of your mouth.
No. And then, of course, you know, another interesting example of desaturation of color was at the end of Taxi Driver, Scorsese desaturized the blood so that it looks rather, artificial, because he thought it was too gory, or that people would think it was too gory.
And that was filmed in color.
They desaturated the blood.
Interesting. In the hotel room?
Yeah. So there's all kinds of, sort of tricks that are done after the fact. Sometimes to please an actor, sometimes to please a censor, for example, to avoid an X rating. Clockwork Orange started out with an X rating. And they realized that this was going to be inhibitive of being able to show it and people would see it. So they basically said, well, what will it take to make it an R rating? And it basically was 2 or 3 little edits, that brought it just in under the R. And of course, Midnight Cowboy went up an X rating, primarily because of what it was about. And won the Academy Award, so that was the first X-rated movie.
And then I didn't even know it was X-rated?
Yeah.
So I watched an X-rated movie, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, my favorite one was the Catholic Church put out a bulletin every week, a list of films. I don't know if you remember.
In the Catholic News.
The Catholic News. And
I was prevented from seeing a hell of a lot of movies.
Well, you know.
Because of that.
And that was the A, which was morally acceptable for all. Mm-hmm. And then there was the B list, which was morally objectionable in part for all. And then the C list was condemned. All the movies I went to see were on that list.
Yeah. Any of my childhood friends that might watch this podcast will smile and remember a big to-do I had when the movie Tommy came out. Mm-hmm. But I won't get into that. But when you were talking about editing Clockwork Orange, I was thinking of another movie, Caligula. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen the director's cut or the uncut version of that?
No, I haven't.
That's a pornographic movie.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And in fact, it's very interesting. I had a student once, and we were talking about how the internet was closing down video stores. And she said, well, the one I work at doesn't seem to be affected. And I said, oh, what video store do you work at? She said, well, it's a triple X. It's a porn. It's a porn thing. And I was like, really? She said, oh, yeah. You know, it's an industry. We have our own magazines. I said, really? There are trade magazines in pornography? She says, I'll bring in some. And she showed me these magazines where basically, you know, it's kind of like exhibitors take note. This film was held over, a lot of boobs.
Well, forget about writing a book. You should try and become a triple X movie.
Critic.
Critic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing was that it was so...
got to be worse jobs.
Oh, yeah. Well, the interesting thing about this whole business that you brought up was that you know, she was talking about there were conventions. And she met Malcolm McDowell at one of those conventions because Caligula is one of the movies that's
and he was in Clockwork Orange.
He was in Clockwork Orange, yeah. Right? But Caligula was apparently one of the, you know, one of the movies that, you know, the convention goers wanted to see.
The uncut version?
Yeah, well, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, no, when I first saw that, I was shocked. Shocked in a pool, Buffalo.
Shocked in a pool.
Well, I hope you do write that book because you obviously know a heck of a lot about film, the nuances involved in it, and the creation process. I know you're coming back for our Department of Education podcast soon, but when the book comes out, I'd like to have it come back and we'll talk about that.
Okay.
And you sit here with the book, you know, like the Johnny Carson show, with the book up, you know. But anyway, I appreciate your time tonight, Mr. Pucci, and we'll see you very soon.
Okay.
And enjoy your retirement, my friend.
I'll try.
And God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you.